Welcome to the program. We talk a great deal about America's changing role in the world. The American century, declared by Henry Luce 70 years ago, may have long since reached its apex. Many view this as a positive sign of humility and a refreshing lack of nationalistic hubris. We also hear arguably too much lately about our growing national debt, caused in large measure by the military expansionism of the past 9 years. Remember, Bill Clinton left us with a surplus back in 2000. The question now is, how are these two ideas related? How is America's foreign policy and our role in the world being shaped or influenced by our economic limitations? And is that a good or a bad development? To discuss this, we're joined by one of the most provocative and insightful thinkers in the realm of foreign policy. He is Michael Mandelbaum. He's the Christian A. Herder Professor of American Foreign Policy and Director of the American Foreign Policy Program at Johns Hopkins. He's formerly a faculty member at Harvard and Columbia and the U.S. Naval Academy. He earned his Ph.D. in political science from Harvard. His newest book is The Frugal Superpower, America's Global Leadership in a Cash-Strapped Era. Michael Mandelbaum, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
Great to have you here. Even if we weren't talking about a cash-strapped economy at the moment, even if we weren't operating at the deficits we see today, wouldn't America's role in the world be changing right now in any case?
It would be changing, but I think not to the same extent that it will change once the impact of the huge and growing obligations of the federal government is felt. For example, I think the political support for persisting in Afghanistan is pretty thin. And even if we were running surpluses as far as the eye could see, the American public would become discontented and impatient with the operations in Afghanistan sooner rather than later. But the fact that we're going to owe so much money in the years ahead and so much more money than we are currently collecting in taxes will put extra pressure on missions such as Afghanistan and other things that the United States does abroad. In fact, I think that the coming obligations of the federal government, the result of the deficits between 2001 and 2007, and those, of course, were in no small part fueled by Afghanistan and Iraq, as you say, but also by the enormous costs of coping with the financial meltdown of the fall of 2008 and the recession that dramatically deepened, and most importantly, that is the most important source of our huge obligations, will be the cost of Social Security and Medicare as the baby boom generation, those Americans, those of us born between 1946 and 1964, begins to retire. Those costs are going to be so high that I believe that they will transform American politics and therefore American foreign policy.
When we think about America's role in the world and American foreign policy, yes, to a certain extent, it's driven by some of these economic forces you're talking about, but also the whole realm of foreign policy right now, when we talk about our relationships with the rest of the world, are also driven by economic interdependence and economic considerations. How does that impact this?
Well, the world is becoming ever more economically interdependent, and the United States is more engaged economically with the rest of the world than ever before. And I would single out two particular features of that interdependence that are noteworthy. First, I believe that the United States plays an important, necessary, and constructive role in the global economy by providing the naval presence that supports and guarantees overseas trade. The American Navy in the Atlantic and the Pacific, which are the world's two great trade routes, helps to ensure that nothing goes wrong with the constant flow of goods back and forth. So we do provide a kind of protective service for global trade, and as pressure on the defense budget mounts, that could be jeopardized. There's another feature that I think is important to note, and that is our growing indebtedness, especially to China. We are not willing to pay as much in taxes as we need to cover our expenditures. If you have a deficit, as we have had chronically and increasingly, there are really only four ways to respond. You can raise taxes, you can cut spending, you can print money, or you can borrow. Well, the first two of these options, cutting spending and raising taxes, are politically unacceptable in the United States, and printing money leads to inflation, and that's economically unacceptable. So we've bridged the gap by borrowing, and we borrowed more and more from abroad, especially from China. And that means that China is our banker, and it's very difficult to have bad relations with your banker. But China does have policies that we have traditionally opposed. And China also has policies, or at least intentions, toward other countries in East Asia that count on us for support in resisting China. And so if relations with China should deteriorate dramatically, the United States might have difficulty in playing our supporting, pacifying, stabilizing role in that part of the world.
What would the events be, in your view, that might lead to more conflict with China?
Most important and explosive issue concerning China is the status of Taiwan. The Chinese, of course, claim that offshore island as part of China. The Taiwanese have been de facto independent for seven decades, ever since the end of World War II when they were freed from Japanese control. And the Taiwanese do not want to be part of China and, in fact, have become a democracy, as China is not. The Chinese have stated that their eventual goal is what they call reunification, and they have also said that if Taiwan formally declared independence, this would be a cause of war for the mainland government. So China's relations with Taiwan are explosive, but so too potentially are some of China's territorial claims in the South China Sea, which impinge on the claims of the other countries in that region. Recently, Secretary of State Clinton was in Asia and announced that the United States did not accept the Chinese position, which meant that we accept the position of Vietnam and Japan and other countries. And so that, too, is a potential source of conflict. I say in The Frugal Superpower that a more aggressive Chinese policy would seriously endanger not only regional but global peace. And making sure that such a Chinese policy does not occur, it depends in part on the American military presence in the region. And that presence, I believe, will come under pressure in this country because of our mounting expenses.
But is it just military presence, or is it coming back to this economic interdependence we talked about before, just as the Cold War principle of mutually assured destruction with respect to nuclear weapons pointed at each other kept the peace for many years of the Cold War? Is there a kind of economic mutually assured destruction that would keep the peace in this new global framework?
Well, it's a good analogy, and I think there is a kind of equivalent of the Cold War nuclear relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union of mutual assured destruction in the economic, or at least the financial, relationship between the United States and China. They hold lots of our debt. They have many dollars, but if they tried to dump those dollars, if they tried to get out of dollars, the value of all dollars would plummet, and so would the value of their remaining store of dollars. And it's also not clear where and to whom they could sell all the dollars that they hold, or the U.S. Treasury securities. But so it would not be rational for China and the United States to get into a tangle. It would not be rational for the Chinese to use force in that part of the world, or at least not economically rational. But unfortunately, we know from history that governments and nations do not always behave rationally. And the Chinese also have political commitments, especially involving Taiwan, that could cause them to override their economic interests. And because that is the case, it is, I think, important for the United States to maintain at least some respectable military presence in East Asia. And certainly the other countries of East Asia believe that. But the question that I pose in the frugal superpower is whether we will be able to continue to afford to do that.
Beyond the price of it, what about the position of the United States vis-a-vis leadership in the world? And as we look at a kind of unipolar world, what about the view of the United States and the rest of the world and how that relates to what we're talking about?
Well, that's a very important point. One of the things that I say in the book is that American global leadership, for all the controversies that it has generated around the world, and of course its specific policies are very controversial in the United States as well, but for all of that, I believe that America's global role as the global leader has been, on the whole, extremely constructive. And not only that, but I think other countries believe that as well. Even as they complain about this or that American policy, they don't want the United States entirely to abandon its role as global leader. And the economic pressure under which this country will come due to these soaring costs, especially, as I say, the costs of Social Security and Medicare, this does put the American leadership role in jeopardy. And one of the points that I make in the book, and one of the points I think is important, is that, ironically, should the United States contract its foreign policy, should it retreat all the way back to the United States, this would impose the greatest penalties not on us, but on people in other countries.
How so?
Because other countries depend on the trade that we guarantee more than we do. Because if the contraction of American power causes international instability, suspicion, arms races, and even war, in the first instance, these will take place in East Asia and in Europe and will not directly affect the United States. Now, because the world is so interdependent these days, ultimately we will be affected, but we would not be on the front lines. For that reason, you would think that other countries would step up to the plate and chip in to help compensate for whatever we are no longer able or willing to do, or able or willing to afford. That would be the rational thing to do, but I do not expect that to happen. And as I point out in the frugal superpower, our natural partners, our historical allies, the democracies of Western Europe, are unlikely to fill any gap in global leadership left by the contraction of American foreign policy, because they are going to be cash-strapped as well. They are operating under some of the same constraints that we are. They all have aging populations. The cost of their social welfare programs are going to increase dramatically in the years ahead. So, unfortunately, this is a case where if the United States doesn't do it, alas, it seems likely that it won't be done.
Does this not place more pressure, then, on the United States to be focused on the projection of soft power in ways that we have neglected for all of these years as a way to offset some of this?
Well, I think what is sometimes called soft power, the power of example, is certainly a part of international politics, but I think it would be dangerous to underrate the power of money and ultimately of armaments. I don't think that we can rely simply on our culture and our reputation and our ideals to do the things that our arms and our money have done. I think there's a limit to how far you can substitute for those. We can't afford to do some things in the future, I think they're just not going to get done.
Are there positive things that might come from this arrangement, from the fact that we will be more cautious going forward to embark on expeditions such as Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yes, I think that is a likely consequence and a very important point, and indeed I devote part of a chapter in the book to making that point. I see the United States as having made two serious blunders in the last two decades, in the two post-Cold War decades. One was the ill-considered and counterproductive decision of the Clinton administration to expand the North Atlantic Treaty Organization toward Russia against the objections of Russia and to no benefit, in my opinion, to the United States. And the other was the invasion of Iraq. And here I focus not so much on the decision to invade in the first instance, because I think that there were legitimate reasons for removing Saddam, of course, although there are, of course, strong arguments against having done so, but rather the way it was done, the cavalier, haphazard way without any serious plan, which has landed us in great difficulties. And I argue in the Frugal Superpower that those two policies came about through the kind of overconfidence that great power breeds. We don't have that margin of safety anymore. I think we will be more prudent, and I trust that we will avoid those kinds of mistakes. So that is actually a benefit of being on a tighter budget. But I fear that the disadvantages will outweigh the benefits.
What about those that argue that to overstate the case, and we see it all the time, deficits don't matter, that these deficits don't matter, that as a percentage of GDP, that the degree to which we are cash-strapped is overstated, and there are some that argue for even greater money being spent to deal with the economic crisis at the moment.
Well, I believe that people who argue for more money being spent, for more stimulus, such as the New York Times columnist Paul Krugman,
right,
are arguing about in favor of doing so only in the short term. Even they concede that these deficits are problematical in the long term and in the medium term. And I'm really talking in the book about the medium and long term. I don't take a position on whether a bigger stimulus would be required at this point. But as for the assertion that deficits don't matter, a memorable assertion by former Vice President Cheney, I think that's simply not true. And I don't think any serious economic observer believes it either. As I said before, if you have deficits, you can deal with them in one of four ways: raising taxes, cutting spending, printing money, or borrowing. We've been borrowing, but borrowing has two drawbacks. One is that the more you borrow, the more you have to pay in interest, so the greater the deficit becomes. And the second is that ultimately you're not going to be able to borrow the money you need. Even the United States doesn't have an infinite capacity to get to be able to borrow money from the rest of the world. And when that happens, you've got a big problem. So I think it is the case that we as a country have been operating on the presumption that deficits don't matter. But that presumption is wrong, and we'll pay for that error.
I want to talk about a fifth way, really, that relates to this broader picture that you're talking about, Michael, and that is that the growth of the economy, which would, even at the current level of taxation, produce significantly more tax revenue to the extent that we're able to continue or that we're able to ramp up GDP, which is a direct relationship to how we deal with our global relationship with the rest of the world.
Well, that's a very good point. Growth makes everything easier. The higher the economic growth is, the bigger the tax revenues, and therefore the smaller the deficit. That's a way of dealing with the deficit by raising tax revenues, but not necessarily by raising taxes. And economic growth is vital, and we ought to be doing everything we can to promote it. However, I don't see the government and the Congress taking steps that are likely to promote robust economic growth. Moreover, even if economic growth does become robust by American standards, and we don't have the capacity to grow double digits per year as China does, because we're a more advanced economy, it's much, much harder to achieve high economic growth. But even if we can achieve very respectable economic growth, the obligations that the federal government has under the Medicare and Social Security laws are so huge that that won't solve the problem. It would mitigate the problem, but it would not eliminate the need to make some difficult choices, which I believe would involve foreign policy. The numbers, as you look at them, and we can be pretty confident of these numbers because the people who are going to be claiming these benefits are now alive.
Mm-hmm.
So unless a meteor or a plague wipes out the entire baby boom generation, we can be pretty confident that the government's obligations are going to tilt sharply upward, so sharply that even economic growth, which you rightly note is vital, won't solve the problem by itself.
One of the interesting things about this, and you touched upon it with regard to Western Europe a few moments ago, is that this also, that this aging of population is a global problem. It's going on in Western Europe, as you mentioned, and it's happening in China as well.
The graying of populations, the so-called demographic transition, is going on everywhere. The demographic transition involves lower mortality rates, lower death rates due to better health care and the advance of science, and lower birth rates for lots of reasons, which means that in the first stages, the population gets older on average, and then in many countries, and certainly all rich countries except the United States, the country gets smaller. And that is a problem because the ratio of people drawing benefits to people who are actually working and generating the revenues to pay those benefits goes up. There are more and more retired people per active worker, and that puts a huge burden on these workers. And because the demographic situation is more acute in Western Europe and most acute in Japan, these are countries that are going to get much older and smaller, whereas the United States will get older, but partly because of immigration and partly because of a higher birth rate, we will not get smaller. Their problems are even more serious than ours, and that is going to be one of the great trends of the next several decades, and as you rightly note, it's going to affect China as well, although it takes effect in China not in this decade, but in the next decade. But the great problem that China faces for several decades in the future is the problem of growing old before it grows rich. And in this, not so much in this decade, but in the decade after this one, this is going to become a very important fact of political life.
The other aspect of all of this that touches on foreign policy and links it with these economic issues is that historically there has been a tendency on the part of the United States and on the part of nations throughout the world to use military adventurism as a way of distracting from homegrown economic problems.
I think you put your finger on a very important feature of international politics, and I think that it may become more pronounced in the years ahead, because there is so much emphasis on economic progress in the world. There is virtually a global consensus on the desirability and feasibility of economic growth. And governments that do not deliver will be looking for diversions. That's a danger with China. If the Chinese government cannot deliver economic growth, there's the danger that the government will harp on nationalism leading to conflict, especially over the issue of Taiwan. We already see it in Russia, where the Putin regime, Mr. Putin was formerly president, now he's prime minister, often sounds an anti-American theme to distract attention from the fact that it has a miserable economic record, all apart from the sale of oil. If it weren't for the rise in the price of oil and gas, Russia would have experienced no growth at all in the last decade. And, of course, one sees it above all in the Arab world, where long-serving dictators with no record of economic accomplishment use anti-Americanism, and especially opposition to Israel, as a way of rallying the countries and the populations against external enemies rather than against the rulers themselves. So I think that is one of the chief problems the world faces, and I have a feeling that it's going to grow worse, not better, in the years ahead.
Which really segues into something else that you talk a lot about, which is our dependence on foreign oil and why we need to address that within the context of these broader issues we've been talking about.
Yes, the one policy recommendation that I make at the end of the Frugal Superpower is to raise the gasoline tax to European and Japanese levels. And those countries pay typically 2.5 to 3 times as much for a gallon of gasoline as we do. And I say this because revenues from the sale of oil go to fund our most serious adversaries. That's certainly true of Iran, and I regard the Islamic Republic of Iran and its ambitions to dominate the Persian Gulf region and the world's oil as the most serious problem the United States faces. But it's also true that some of the massive oil revenues that accrue to Saudi Arabia find their way into the hands of terrorist groups. And that's one reason that it's true, that is the reason that it's true, that we in the United States are fighting a war against terrorism and funding both sides. And oil revenues also support Mr. Putin in Russia and Mr. Chavez in Venezuela. And with lower oil revenues, they would make far less trouble. Now, the United States is the world's biggest consumer of oil, so if we consumed less, there would be less global demand and revenue streams to our adversaries would shrink. The way to promote lower oil consumption in the United States is with a higher gasoline tax, which would have two consequences. First, it would lead to conservation. We would all use less. And second, it would promote substitution. Alternative forms of fuel and energy would become commercially viable, such as ethanol or electrically powered automobiles. And because of this, there would be massive private investment in the technologies needed. But, of course, in the short run, Americans would have to pay more. Some Americans would suffer. There would have to be legislation to compensate people who depend on long-distance driving. And for that reason, it turns out, and I follow this issue very closely, that a higher gasoline tax is about as unpopular a measure as there is in the United States. I know of no elected public official in the United States who favors it. So it's not going to happen anytime soon, but I do believe, and I argue in the Frugal Superpower, that raising the gasoline tax sharply is the single most important measure the United States could take to secure our interests overseas.
And as you've talked about, and as your friend and colleague Tom Friedman has talked about, it is also a way to stimulate the kind of economic growth we were talking about before.
I believe that it would be a great stimulus to the kind of thing at which America excels, namely technological innovation. If it were clear that the price of oil were going to remain high for a long time, there would be a huge demand for energy-efficient technologies throughout the society, especially in the automotive sector. And we are the country best equipped to make those innovations, to produce those technologies, and sell them to the rest of the world. So in the long term, I think it would be a huge gain for the United States, both in terms of security and economically. But in order to get to the long term, you have to get through the short term. And it's hard to persuade people to do that. In fact, so far it's proven impossible.
Ideally, and finally, what could we look for, what might we look for from our traditional allies in the world to help bridge the gap created by America's cash-strapped leadership right now?
I wish I could be confident or even optimistic that we would receive the kind of support that is in their interest. But what we see in Europe is countries cutting back on their diplomatic representation and cutting back dramatically on their already not very formidable militaries. So I return to the point that I made before, and it is one of the rueful points I make in The Frugal Superpower. It's not fair, it's not right, it's not healthy, but it is the case, alas, I believe, I'd like to be proven wrong, but I believe that it is, in the end, up to the United States.
Michael Mandelbaum, his must-read book is The Frugal Superpower, America's Global Leadership in a Cash-Strapped Era. It is just out from Public Affairs. Michael, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.